Right. Yeah, so if you repeat any questions, it's probably a good idea. It's only got that little microphone.
Yeah, head fish out, Louis.
Just the one then.
Why not?
Turn around, shall we? So, obviously the audience here has probably got an idea of the kind of questions they might like to ask. One or two of the people here. So, I mean, just like the
kick off with a question. I've got to leave, unfortunately, for the airport. But, for Andrew, I read on Slashdot that GPL was a test of the GPL which was upheld.
Right.
Which was what? Could you give us the significance or otherwise?
Right. I wonder which one that's referring to. I mean, the last one the German one. Yeah. So the last one I'm aware of is the German one. It's very interesting when people say, is the GPL enforceable or not? I mean, they're sort of really asking a number of different questions. The basic question, which is, if you take a piece of code which is issued under the GPL and then you do something with it which is not permitted by the GPL, is that a breach of copyright law? I mean, the answer to that is yes. You know, it's a pretty trivial question, pretty trivial answer, and no lawyer has got any sort of real dispute over that. I mean, since the GPL is purely something that gives you rights, and since the original copyright holder retains those rights, the copyright holder is under no obligation to give those rights in the first place. So by saying that it's unenforceable, the effect of that would be that the person who's claiming rights under it would have no rights at all. So it's not in anyone's benefit to claim that the GPL is unenforceable. So, a license is something that gives you certain rights. It gives you certain rights under certain conditions. If you don't fulfil those conditions, you don't get the rights. And therefore, if you continue to try to exercise them, you're in breach of copyright law, and therefore the copyright owner's got a claim against you, and you may be in breach of the criminal law as well. So that's pretty straightforward, and that's certainly what the German cases and all the other cases that I've seen uphold that. And, you know, I've never met a copyright lawyer that would actually have any serious debate about that. That implies that the GPL is what's known technically as a bare license. And, you know, if you want to carry on going on, it is actually much more interesting to consider what the situation would be if the GPL was a contract. And if it's a contract, then the effect of somebody breaching it is not simply that they no longer have rights under that license anymore. It means that the right holder, that somebody claiming under it may be able to assert additional rights. And the interesting consequence of that is whether somebody who... we take the example of... I'm trying to think of some practical example here. Let us say, for the sake of argument, that a large software company has developed an extremely successful piece of proprietary software, and it's later discovered that within that software there lurks a piece of code which was subject to the GPL. Now... under the analysis that I've just talked about, the effect of that would be if they do not release the... if they distribute that software and they do not comply with the terms of the GPL in terms of releasing the source code, etc., making it available, so on and so forth, then there would be a claim against them from the original copyright owner of that piece of GPL code, which would enable them to get an injunction to prevent that piece of code from being further distributed on. But what's much more interesting is if a third party can come along and say, ah, yes, that piece of proprietary software, there are rights granted to me under the GPL, a third party, in that proprietary software. I'm going to compel you, the company producing proprietary code, to release that piece of the source code underlying that code. Now, that can only... I'm sorry, this is getting sort of hideously technical, and I wish there was a way that I could explain it more simply. But basically, the sort of nuclear concerns that the proprietary software companies have, they're much scarier in a scenario where the GPL is deemed to be a contract and enables third parties to gain rights under it than if it's deemed simply to be a licence, in which case, if they're found to be breaching, then, okay, they're in breach of the Copyright Act and they have to pay some damages and they may have to stop distributing that piece of software. But it does not compel that piece of software to automatically become GPL'd and therefore to be made available for free to a much wider audience. I hope that made a degree of sense. I have a horrible feeling that I just tried to explain something that I would have to essentially put into a PhD thesis. Anyway, that's basically the answer to the question is, as far as I'm concerned, the GPL is enforceable as a license. I don't think anyone's got any major arguments against that. The more interesting question is it enforceable as a contract? And, version 3 explicitly says it's not a contract. I think that may be a mistake in certain circumstances. Version 2 doesn't explicitly say one way or the other. And a number of commentators think it probably is a contract. I suspect it isn't, but as far as I know, no court has actually ruled on that particular point.
Sorry.
Now nobody else is going to ask me a question.
Follow up on that, on the GPL, actually on GPL 3,
yeah,
which is something of a hot, and this is to you all the panellists. What do you think the effect is of GPL 3? How do you view it from your different points of view, technically, legally, socially, etc.? Do you think it's a good thing or a bad thing? I'm sorry, this is a whole series of questions I'm throwing at you, but what's your general view of GPL 3?
I think the fact that it's taken like sort of 11 years to put together suggests that it's a pretty complex issue. There's probably no easy answer, it's a good thing or it's a bad thing. I mean, it's been thought about apparently in some like 15,000 emails between Richard Stallman and Evan Modlin. They've discussed this issue, so you can imagine it's a pretty complex thing. I interviewed Evan Modlin recently, and he sort of talked me through the basics, but I think some of the other people here probably got positions on this in terms of whether it's a good thing or a bad thing, because clearly it changes some fairly fundamental aspects of the GPL.
So. I think it's true. First of all, you can't really talk about GPL 3 because it's not finished. So you're talking about a GPL 3 draft something, and there will be more changes. The point of this long drafting process is to try and figure out the consensus, figure out what works across a very wide range of legal regimes, and to do it in a way which doesn't upset large numbers of people. So there's some things I think you can, from the open source community perspective, that most people are very happy with. Some of the clarifications, for example, make it much more obvious what is intended by the license in modern terms. It deals with the change from command line programs to graphical and web programs. So the GPL version 2 talks about printing on the console messages about something being GPL. Version 3 deals with the fact that this might, in a modern program, it's going to be a dialogue box or a web page, and so you want to protect that dialogue box or web page in the same way as you protect a printed message. There is a lot less consensus over the patents part of it, and even more so over the digital rights management part. Now, the patents part is currently optional. So effectively, if you are providing a piece of GPL code, you can say, and this clause applies, or you can say, and this clause doesn't apply to my bit. There's awkward questions there which I don't think have really been answered, like if you combine two pieces of code, one which says it does, one which says it doesn't, do you effectively have this viral thing where programs gradually increase in GPLness, so to speak? Because as you mix bits of GPL code together, they keep acquiring more and more of the optional things. The other big issue for some of the projects, like the Linux project, the kernel, is that the kernel was put together by a large number of people, including many companies, and it was put together under GPL version 2. And there is a concern, particularly on part of people like Linus, that he has no right to change that license. In effect, it's no different to you buying a piece of proprietary software, coming to renew the license 2 years later, discovering that even though you really rely on it, you're no longer eligible to use it. And that's what would actually happen to some of the contributors. Sorry about that. TiVo is a great example, right? They have contributed to the Linux kernel. If Linux adopts GPL version 3, then TiVo can no longer use it. So you're changing the rules on people. And there's a moral question there rather than a legal question. There's a related question anyway, because it's possible that GPL version 2 already covers the digital rights management issues. Various legal people have scratched their heads over it. I don't think there's any case law or anything. But the actual wording talks about all of the scripts and other things necessary. And so there is a question whether that therefore includes any encryption keys. So that bit out. In general, I think it's one of those things which is going to take a lot of time before people are necessarily happy with. And I think a lot of the older projects, particularly for the moral and philosophical reason, are probably going to stay with the old license. At least unless something happens, for example, in a court of law, where everyone goes, ooh, okay, there's a real nasty problem with that version of the license, we need a new one.
I suppose I would say something, but I don't know that I've got very much to add to it. I'm going to slightly come out on a limb here. I think everyone's been fairly diplomatic on the licence as well. I personally like it, by the way, but I'm not speaking on behalf of any organisation. It is very brave. It is attempting to address some real live issues in the software community, the free software an open source community, as Alan and Ben have mentioned already. It's specifically aimed at addressing various issues like software patents. One of the things to bear in mind is that the GPL is a worldwide used license as well. Again, as the guys have pointed out, there's an awful lot of different points of view that have been taken into it, including a lot of points of view from the UK. There's a number of organisations who have been involved in looking at the GPL, annotating it, giving advice on it as well. As a matter of interest, if anyone here wants to get involved in the conversation, that's quite possible as well. The FSF have got a very, very well annotated version of the GPL 3 and description for what it's intended to do on their website, and they've got a very, very clever system for annotating it as well. And you can see in real time the debate as it's emerging around it. They've got an interesting colour code which shows which bits of the discussion around the GPL are hot, shall we say. I personally think it's very brave. It's aimed at addressing some of the key issues that are affecting free software, open source, whatever you want to call it. And most specifically, DRM, software patents, which are very live in Europe. And as Alan says, I think it will be resolved at some point. There's still a long way to go. I think the next formal meeting around it is about June, July, isn't it?
Yeah. It's very spaced out.
Absolutely. And there's no final decision until about March or so next year, isn't it? Something like that.
I can't remember.
But there's still a long way to go on it as well. And also, as Alan has pointed out, there is no necessity, there's no compulsion to move to the next version of the GPL. The GPL 2 will be around probably for a long time to come.
The open source community doesn't, certain projects are very, very good at addressing that. The three mentioned there have good media and marketing sort of efforts going on. But other projects don't. Is there any way to sort of address that, have a centralized, or would it be deemed feasible to have something centralized to sort of deal with open source in general and bring that position across more widely to these sort of mainstream
office of propaganda?
Sorry.
don't think it's in the nature. I don't think it's in the nature of the beast for there to be any sort of centralised area. The community evolves its own people addressing different things. I mean, notionally, the FSF can be deemed authoritative on issues relating free software, the OSI on issues of what is and isn't an open source license. But I don't think we're going to see a central office of open source propaganda arising.
I'm surprised and interested by a perspective, because it's not the one that I have. I mean, as a journalist, I mean, I keep a close eye on what other people are writing. It seems to me when you do get a dubious bit of research from the other side, it gets pounced on pretty fast and pretty hard. And I've done some pouncing myself, you know. So I think there is quite a sort of a movement on the part of journalists to be cynical about this stuff and to write about it. So I'm surprised it's still having an effect.
I'm wondering if it's leaving a level of doubt with possibly just people I'm working with. It might be a small group.
Can you be specific about the kind of projects that you have a problem with?
Small businesses, 10 to sort of 30.
And so what's the kind of stuff that's upsetting them? Is it Microsoft's TCO stuff?
It's the get the facts from Microsoft. It's some technical articles on the vulnerabilities and the fixing and the cycle of the patching cycle of the open source.
Yeah.
And the variability of it. And I think that combined is scaring quite a few of them away from. It's also coming from vendors. They're also getting things from the current vendors of PC World Business, being a big one, who are coming back and saying, no, because this is bad.
Well, that's the problem, because I never get to hear about that, and therefore you can't fight it. I mean, it's a kind of subtle whispering campaign, isn't it?
I think you can fight that anyway, because a lot of those companies selling proprietary software. I mean, the biggest place we've seen is the NHS. It's one of the reasons for the pending collapse of the NHS data spy. Is there is a huge interest these companies all have in proprietary software, right? So you don't want to sell someone something which undermines your own lock-in. So if you build a padlock around somebody else's padlock, which is what a lot of these people are doing, then you don't want someone else to come in and pick the lock on the inside that you rely on. It's even worse for the hardware, with the hardware sellers. Because even the sort of pro-Linux or allegedly neutral hardware sellers, even they take that position at the board level, their sales guys are on commission. And if they sell you Windows XP OpenOffice Professional, they've doubled the size of their sale, they've doubled the commission. And they don't have the interest of the consumer at heart. And I think what's really, really telling, and the one thing I always point out to the people who say this when I get the chance to, all of the propaganda is aimed at people who have not yet adopted open source. There is no propaganda aimed at the people who already did, because it's too late.
Yes.
These people have the experience, and their experience tells them that the papers on whole don't lie. Don't get me wrong, there are cases open source does not work. But in general, and you took that, you get, one thing we find, you get people talking to each other. And one business says to another, we've heard all this dodgy open source stuff. And the other one says, we haven't had a virus attack for 9 months. And that counts so much more. And that's why things like this BCS stuff will be important, and the small business stuff, and the work that's been done by the man next to me. And getting companies to talk to each other means that they actually get the information that counts. See, they get information from the community even to an extent, but certainly information from Linux vendor A versus non-Linux vendor B. But no technical information. Who's lying?
I guess my point is that the small business area is the area where if there's a decent amount of adoption, you've got companies that are going to be growing using this stuff from the get-go. There are other companies that are ones that don't have. Windows base is already, they find it difficult to move regardless because they already have blocking. And it's difficult sometimes to find impartial information. I'm saying impartial, the Microsoft information is dealt with as it's Microsoft. It must be fairly accurate. It's very difficult to find something on the flip side from companies that are trusted, household names that you've been researching with that.
And my master's research was actually partly on that, and it backs up exactly what you said. The single thing which was driving Linux adoption the most in companies was having somebody in the company who knew something about Linux. And the senior people I talked to, the essential theme coming from them was, all the stuff out there is technical, it's not neutral enough. At the end of the day, We made the decision because the person we trust is the guy we've worked with for 5 years. Okay, he's only the techie. He's been talking about this damn Linux thing. He won't shut up about it. We come to look at it. He's our only trustable source of information. And they see that as a problem. Because obviously they would like an authoritative source.
I'd like to pick up on this theme and enhance it as well, because that's exactly what we've found in the commercial practice of it as well. Obviously, member companies have discovered that the pattern, if there is one, it's very difficult to characterise patterns in open source because it's not a product. I hate the word, but I can't think of any other paradigm, a way of doing this kind of stuff. It's not one thing. There's open source products, inverted commas, all over the place. But the common pattern in companies adapting it is exactly as Alan is saying. There is a, hesitate to use the word, but an interested or passionate technical person in the organisation who's either had a lot of experience or has recently started working with Linux, maybe at home. And there is a layer of management, the higher up the better, that are prepared to listen to the story on it. There's a number of issues with the advocacy, as we've heard here. An awful lot of the information out there is purely technical, which, as you're pointing to, is not necessarily compelling for management. And one of the things which needs to happen, and there's been quite a few press articles about this, it's part of the work that we're doing as well, is there need to be very understandable, clear case studies of companies that have moved and a non-technical explanation of that, what it actually means for them in financial terms, in maintenance terms, and in all of the parameters by which management assess different technologies.
You mentioned the NHS. Just in regard to the public sector, for instance, I know that the Office of Government Commerce has produced two fairly positive and by their standards substantial reports in 2002 and 2004.
Yes.
But is there a disconnect of some sort? Because have they had the influence that you think that these reports would have? Because other articles have then gone and reviewed the NHS in the background of this, and they say, yeah.
The NHS is one of several particularly complicated ones. Because it's easy for someone like the Office of Government Computing to do the work they have done. And there's also been a parliamentary committee looked at some of this as well. So they've done the serious work and they've said, well, here are the facts about open source. Here is the government's view on open source. We've tried to be as neutral and accurate as possible. But to translate that, you've then got to have a way for government bodies to choose to use that information and to deploy it. So the first barrier there is lack of people higher up in the civil service, like in any in commercial organisations, with the necessary skills. The second barrier is the purchasing barrier, because a lot of government departments for large purchases are not able to purchase from everyone they like. So small and medium business is quite happy to deploy a little bit of Linux, hear the problem, go down the local university computer society and say, who here wants to work one Saturday a week supporting us? Here's ridiculously low amounts of money, but you're a student, you're 18, you won't know any better. Local government can't do that. Central government can't do that. Once you get to really, really big things, like the big NHS projects, there are very, very few organisations which have all the necessary credentials, authorisations, all of the other crap you need to do business. All of those companies are currently essentially Windows-based. None of them derive a commercial advantage themselves from ceasing to be Windows-based, that I can see. So regardless of what the customer's interest is, it's not in any of the players' interest, and there's no way for anyone else to enter easily. That's the kind of lock-in problem you get. Exactly the same reason when you start getting the military paying $10,000 US for a toilet seat. So it's this kind of lock-in thing. Because they can't go down the local hardware store and buy one. It's got to come through the purchasing system.
Right. So do you see this sort of disconnect between an appreciation of what they could do and what they can do as continuing, despite the tremendous impetus that it gives to the whole business and sort of software adoption?
They're also very risk averse, which is another thing which ties to what you're saying. I think there is a certain amount of disconnect in the sense of people look at it and saying this is good. But a lot of the disconnect, I think, is people look at it and say, Office of Government Computing say this. All the people who are making the decision on the technical side have all sorts of Windows qualifications, and thank you, they like the fact that they control it. The local government senior people don't have the knowledge necessarily, and even if they do have the knowledge, they are working in a job environment where you get fired for being adventurous rather than fired for delivering something that works even if it's expensive. So I don't think it's a disconnect in the sense of people not believing each other. I think it's a disconnect in the sense of you've got different power groups, and none of those power groups are actually interested in the correct final result, even though they're all working for to optimise their little bit of the problem.
Is it different in Europe? Are there, well, I know the famous case was Munich was supposedly moving from mass to... did that ever happen?
It's in the process of happening.
Is it going to happen yet?
I think so.
People involved would say yes.
That's a complicated one. That's a deeply political one. It's very tied to the politics of the German Green Party, for example. And so it's not trivial to judge. There have certainly been trials in other countries. I don't know enough about the public office systems and the public voting system of other countries to answer the question.
There is one of the sources of information for looking at that is that there's been some very good analysis done on it by a gentleman called Rishab Ghosh, who's heads up the merit programme at the University of Maastricht. And there's been a number of EU-funded studies. The most recent work that Rishab did was on the economics of open source and the economics of open standards. And part of the work that he did on that was a comparative analysis of different European countries and their state of adoption of free software, open source software. And yes, the rumours are true. Britain isn't as far as a number of other European countries on it, yeah? It's not as far back as is widely believed. One of the issues is in the publicising of the open source case studies we do have in the public sector. Interestingly, Wales is probably way ahead of the curve in absolutely Powys, Carmarthen and Shear. There's an awful lot of open source implementations in county councils around in Wales, but they're not unique by any means. And that's part of the issue, which is the information not getting out there. Going back to your original question of the disconnect between policy and what actually people are doing, yes, that's very true. The thing to understand is that we're still fairly early in the curve. Now, as has been mentioned, politicians and civil servants are very cautious, shall we say. There's an element of fudging in a number of papers and people not really willing to go too far out on the limb. The OGC report was great as far as it went. There are some new reports that are coming out that will go further. Some of the work that we've been doing recently is with the Scottish Executive, who are currently preparing a report on open source in the public sector, and they will be going further in some of their statements. There's also further moves in other branches of government as well. Tomorrow, in fact, is the second meeting of BECTA, who are the people who are the policy advisors in the educational market. And our very good friends, Schoolforge, have been doing a lot of work with BECTA. We've been doing some work with them as well. And we're hoping for some very positive steps forward out of that meeting. Many of you here will remember the BECTA meeting last year produced, or was on the eve of them publishing their report, which said that schools would save massive, massive amounts of money in moving to open source. They said, based on a three-year study, that primary schools could save up to 50% of their IT budget, secondary schools 30 or 40%. We're hoping for some moves forward from BECTA out of the meeting tomorrow as well. The education market is an excellent example of the disconnect between policy. Yeah, where we're getting some very, very positive statements coming out of organisations like BECTA advocating moves to open source. And then you have some interesting implementations in that schools can spend money on software licences, which is kind of a problem for free software. Yeah, so there's more that needs to happen.
Yes,
very much so, of course. It's under the Creative Commons license. if you check it out, it's the Merit Programme, University of Maastricht. Just Google for Rishab Ghosh. R-I-S-H-A-B. No worries.
Or for Floss. F-L-O-S-S. F-L-O-S-S. Because the European Union needed a neutral term to cover all the ideas. Free software, Libre, open source. They got Floss. Free Libre and open source software. Because they...
It's known for my wife, so I'll be able to remember.
Yes. But there's this whole debate about kind of the politics and the subtle differences. For their research purposes, they really didn't care. And they didn't want to offend anybody or make it appear biased. So they called it Floss.
Rishab Ghosh. R-I-S-H-A-B. G-H-O-S-H. And yet Floss or Floss Polls, you'll find it.
He's also done some other very interesting work if you look around his pages as well.
Absolutely. Right.
He did some very good stuff looking into TCO and the whole failure of the concept of total cost of ownership.
Yeah.
When you start, for example, comparing between countries. So in India, where your people cost is tiny, your hardware cost is huge, versus the US, where it's completely the reverse, now you just can't generalise TCO.
But the other thing to remember about these figures is that very often they come out with figures like Windows is 7.63% better than open source. I mean, if you look at the methodology, it's absolutely absurd because they're trying to calculate things you probably know to one significant figure and they're drawing out two or three significant figures at the end. So, I mean, just from a basic sort of methodology viewpoint, it's just nonsense. I mean, basically, they're roughly the same. I mean, that's all you can say about it.
Or some interesting initial conditions. My favourite one was the one which announced that Windows Server was far more cost-effective than Samba. And based on two processors, and they'd run it on a commodity unit from Dell, and the two processors for the Samba implementation was on an IBM mainframe.
Yes.
They actually had to retract that one from the advertising agency.
That's the journalist call on that one.
Yeah, that was a great...
But, I mean, that's what I was saying about the comment of, you know, rebutting these things. I mean, they're not really worth that much. I mean, it's good for just...
They could backfire horribly. And there was a Microsoft thing long, long time ago, which was published around, it was over close to the press, but it was sort of passed around with their information packs and stuff. And one thing is, there was Linux couldn't do wireless. Mm-hmm. And after that came out, everybody anywhere who did a Linux presentation pointedly had a wireless card in their machine. Mm-hmm. Because what happened then is that they saw this Linux laptop wireless card. And they always said, well, I thought Linux didn't do wireless. Oh, it does wireless, look, I'll show you. At that point, it totally destroyed the credibility of the opposition. That one backfired beautifully.
Mm. Moral of the story is don't say can't do.
But also I think it's significant that, you know, Microsoft is already looking at further areas where it can try and discredit. I mean, the latest one is obviously the patent one that Borman's saying that, you know, if there were some kind of infringement, they might possibly be forced to take some action. I mean, he's got to the stage of offering very vague kind of threats, because clearly all the previous five or six methods, which included calling, you know, Linux a cancer, and then using the TCO...
Communists.
Yeah,
and then don't forget the original study with Netcraft, which was to do with the speed of GNU Linux. I mean, they've been through every possible combination of factors, and so the TCO is just one of them, and they're clearly moving on from that now, because that hasn't really worked. Obviously, it's having some effect. But
don't you think that Microsoft are running scared if they resort into that kind of...
Absolutely. And I think that's the thing to say, is that why has it gone through these six stages of trying to vilify open source and yet maintain that it's not really a threat and it'll never catch on? I mean, it's hardly a consistent position.
So I've got two questions that are slightly further afield. The first one is intellectual property a good term, and if not, what's the replacement? And the other one is open source has been increasingly applied to other domains such as encyclopedias or maps. Which of the new ones are more interesting and which haven't been done yet?
Intellectual property is a good term. To me, it's totally neutral. I come across all sorts of different property in my work, ranging from real property, which has a particular bundle of rights attached to it, to physical and personal property, which has a different bundle of rights attached to it, to intellectual property, which has a separate bundle of rights attached to it. So, you know, to me, it's not the fact it's called intellectual property. It doesn't colour it in a particular way. I don't come at it with a sort of bunch of preconceptions. So, in a sense, I'm not the right person to ask the question. I don't know whether it does have some preconceptions for other people.
That's something I feel quite strongly about.
Yeah.
But I think it is the wrong term.
Yes.
Because if you think about what it is, it's basically a monopoly. So we should be calling it an intellectual monopoly that's granted by the government for a certain period. If it's, in the case of copyright, it's now 70 years plus. If it's patents, then it's a shorter time period, but it's a monopoly. And so all these extensions, they're not extensions of an artist's right, they're extensions of a monopoly. And if you start saying monopoly, then you think, well, I don't like monopolies. Why am I extending monopolies? And I think, really think we should call them intellectual monopolies. I mean, there are good reasons for having them, because... No, but they are. I mean, in a literal sense, I mean, I think you'd agree that that's what they are.
I mean, philosophically, I absolutely agree that they, you know... From my point of view, the reason they exist is purely to maximise creativity. And, you know, and there is no question in my mind that copyright goes far too far.
And therefore, if you start looking as monopolies, and I think you're absolutely right to focus on that, and say, well, OK, it's a monopoly, there are reasons for giving it, and if you're an author or a musician, you want to have a monopoly in your creativity... But do you need it for 90 years after your death? Probably not, because it's not really going to do very much good. So you think, well, okay, this is a monopoly. We don't like monopolies generally, so we have to have a good reason for granting it. So what should be the right term? So I think if we started talking about intellectual monopolies, it is a question of words, I think, that's being very cleverly used by the big creative industries. They're also invoking the artist and their right to... get some money from this, but if you started using the word monopoly, it's a bit hard to twist it, and you have to go back to the fact of it's an incentive. Let's talk sensibly in economics terms. What's the right number? And don't forget that, you know, copyright started out with 14 years plus 14, and as you know, there is this new campaign, 14 plus 14. The Economist itself suggested that that might be the right term, that we've gone a little bit too far getting to the 70 plus. So I feel very strongly that we should call it intellectual monopolies.
Yeah, I'd like to have a go at this one as well, because I agree very strongly with that. And I've got a number of issues with it, and there's two I'll speak about. One I'd like to pick up on Glyn's point here is the words we use to describe something absolutely have an effect. And hence you have things like the FSF's renaming of digital rights management as digital restrictions management. And trusted computing is treacherous computing. It's real. Yeah, it's very real. One of the issues I had with it is on this point itself, in that words have an effect in the mind. They imply something which may or may not be there. Sorry to go a bit philosophical, but the notion is, if you attach the word property to intellectual property, it has certain implications which may or may not hold. The notion of property comes from this stuff. The rules of the world of intellectual property are different. Here's just one example. In physical property, scarcity is a fact. The whole of economics is based on scarcity, yeah? And the whole theory is about it. In the intellectual world, perhaps that doesn't hold. An example of that is the old saying, give a man a fish, teach a man to fish. Yeah? Classic example. Another example of that in the world of software, and it raises all sorts of issues, is tell me, what is the cost of duplicating software? What's the marginal cost? Nothing. Or as near to nothing as to be irrelevant. Yeah. And there's all sorts of implications to this, which I don't want to get into. All I want to point out is that the laws of the intellectual economy may or may not be the same as the physical economy. I assert that they're very different and different rules apply. That's one objection. And the other one is pretty much along the... No, I've forgotten what it is, so I'm going to shut up for a minute. It might come back.
That was enough.
That was enough.
I don't have any problem using the term intellectual property, particularly in things like legal arguments. Because if you're talking with lawyers, lawyers are very clear on what intellectual property is. And they have a kind of a proper understanding of it. It's a very dangerous phrase in the public because it implies all sorts of things about the real world property and similarities that aren't there. There's a more deep-rooted problem with it as well, which is that some of the problem we have with so-called intellectual property actually comes from this trying to treat it as property. And with the real world, the legal system spent a good 200 years having figured out this idea that you've got this thing called property. Then we're well, actually, we need rule. You're going to build railways. Well, we're going to need compulsory purchase and way leave and and it has evolved. And the intellectual property thing has been, we've had the land grab, we've had the Enclosure Act, if you like, but we haven't really then had the rest of the ramifications sort out. So calling it property implies it's complete in a manner which is not. Whereas if you think about intellectual, you know, monopoly, as you like, as a different thing, it does frame the debate better in terms of, if it's a monopoly, what are the checks you have on the monopoly? Abuse is one. Is there a way of doing it not a monopoly? So, for example, it would be very, very easy to fix the patent system, at least at a technical level, because all you have to do is if you can assign an approximate value to a patent, then you can have arbitrary compulsory licensing. So you change the entire patent system from a monopoly to a right to royalty. And all of a sudden, how do you compete? Well, you can't compete by locking competitors out. Yes, they'll have to pay you for your brilliant invention, but when they invent something brilliant, you depend on, you'll be paying each other back. So it would actually really drive invention, for example, rather than driving lock-in and market control. When you think about patents and monopolies in that kind of way, it's much more obvious what's going on.
Yeah. That was the second point that I wanted to make about intellectual property as well, in that it no longer reflects the reason that it was created in the first place. Yeah, the reason it was created, the notion of patents and intellectual property in the first place, was to protect small inventors for their ideas. If you look in the real world at the actual real practice around it, that no longer applies.
So it may not have applied originally. You know the story of James Watt?
Yes.
And how he sat on his patents for 30 years and stopped the development of the steam engine. He's not the hero we all thought.
Well, he had a passion to believe that high-pressure steam was dangerous.
And basically, as soon as that patent ended, then the development took off.
There's lots of history like
that. I mean, right at the beginning, you could argue it wasn't true.
There's another thing which you be careful about, because computer software is very, very weird in the sense that copyright normally protects expression on something you can see. So, like copyright on a book, where you can read the book, you can learn from the book, you can understand the style of the book. Patents protect machines, and in machines, you don't have copyright. So, you can actually take it apart, study it, learn from it. Computer software, somehow, the copyright law protects you in a way which is the equivalent to requiring a license to open the book. And that makes it very, very dangerous. Now, when you start adding patents, as well as they did in the US, you end up with one particular area of industry which is protected as a machine. It's protected as if it were a literary work, but you can't read it either. It's kind of triple protected, and that's what's causing a lot of the problems.
Perhaps we could follow up with the second part of your question about other areas, but it leads naturally into that. And obviously, you talked about enclosure, and as you know, there's the Creative Commons movement, which is really trying to counter that with a commons, in other words, land or ideas that are held in commons, and that is the whole business of the kind of open content movement. And that, I think, is flourishing largely through the framing of a range of licenses by the Creative Commons. I know that certain people have criticisms, like Richard Stallman at the start, but they have been very successful in liberating people to provide other rights in the materials that they produce. In fact, as it happens, I was interviewing Larry Lessig yesterday, and he was saying that he thinks that one of the main achievements of open source will be as an example to others, including himself, in other areas. Mm-hmm. And in some ways, it will actually be more important because that kind of creativity is open to everyone in this room, everyone in this city, everyone in this country, whereas writing software is not something that everyone can do. So the open content movement potentially is going to embrace more people than the open source movement. So that's an example of where open source's ideas are actually spreading out very successfully to
Well, yeah, I think I know how to answer your question as to where we go, where that will lead. What we've seen with open source, with Wikipedia, as with your case with OpenStreetMap, is projects that work to some degree, small or large, where there is an existing artificial scarcity of data, or artificial restriction on data, things like map data, encyclopedia, and where it is possible to replicate that information by individual or by group effort. So in other words, where you can actually just go round and make the same measurements or do the same things, record the same data, That is where just having a large number of people doing a small amount of work can make a big difference. And that leads, I think, ultimately, probably leads on to a large amount of household products, because we are starting to get to the point in the engineering world where people are building interesting machines which are, for want of a better description, 3D printers. In other words, given a CAD drawing, you can print yourself an object. Now, we're not at the point where you can print yourself a chair yet or anything particularly physically strong. But you would think if that kind of technology improves, that is the logical direction it goes, where you download an open source chair and print one. And the company I want to have shares in is the company that makes the toner.
Yeah, quite.
Have you been talking to Michael Hart about that?
No.
Project Gutenberg, that's exactly what he says. He says that Project Gutenberg, which I'm sure you all know, has come out to 20,000 completely public domain books. And I've spoken to him about this, and I was amazed that he doesn't really regard this as actually anything particularly important, because he sees it as just one step towards this vision that Alan was outlining. He wants to have open source manufacturing. He wants to have an open source world where, instead of just being able to download Great Expectations and print it out if you want to, you want to be able to download the chair or download a jumbo jet or whatever and just print it out. So he's a man of similar visions. So it's interesting that two people arrived at the
same
point.
The CAA may have things to say about that.
Legal constraints, yeah. I mean, there are lots of other areas. Some that interest me in particular, what I call open genomics, which is actually another name for bioinformatics, which is the whole human genome project. If you think about it, it's actually just another open source project, because the human genome, which is code, is a quaternary code instead of binary code. And that's been a very successful application of open source ideas. You've got, as I said, the open content, which embraces the things like Wikipedia, wikis, blogs, also really a kind of open content if you think about them, very low level. You've got a lot of music happening, again, under the Creative Commons licenses. There's something called open science, which is starting to formulate itself as a kind of separate entity, which is where you have open access to the papers, but you also have open access to the data. So you have open data, because that's becoming quite a critical issue when the data of a scientific experiment is just as important as the results you draw from it. So there are lots of other domains where people are being inspired, I think, by open source ideas.
Tangentially related, this was a question I really wanted to ask at the licensing meeting of this group a couple of months ago, but unfortunately I couldn't attend. It's about the implications of the UK Freedom of Information Act and, to a certain extent, the GDPR, possibly even for access to artificially scarce data like mapping data. But there are organisations such as universities which use open source free software quite heavily and make modifications to it to fit it in with their own existing campus systems or whatever. What would be the situation with code being requested under the Freedom of Information Act from that organisation and obviously then made available to you to read? Would you then be able to take that, is that distributing the software in the GPL sense? You'd be able to take that code and use it in other areas that are not controlled by the organisation that made it? Because until they release that code, it's just internal modifications of the GPL. They don't have to be distributed. If they distribute it as a response to the Freedom of Information Act, can you then distribute it further?
Fantastic question.
it's actually very live as well. One of the projects we're involved with is that there's a group of GPs in Scotland who are doing precisely this via the NHS at the moment. So we have a live test of that. We're going into legal on that one.
I mean, I'll
have a chat with you later.
You probably need to answer the legal. There is an actual real-world example of this in the United States where the law is a little different. Because the US government created things are owned by the people of the United States of America. An intelligent idea that they came across and we never quite got. And Freedom of Information Act was used to extract the source code to a system which ran the US veterinarians' hospitals and DPs and stuff. And that has now become an open public system which is being used by various GPs and other projects in the US. but it's very different to the UK system, so that because it was American government owned, once it became, was out there, it was public, there was no dispute. So I'll leave you to answer the question. Or are you is that somebody's thesis that's just been designed?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's down to what the word distribution means. If, you know, unfortunately, distribution is not a term of art under English law. So, you know, at the end of the day, it's going to be a judge who decides. And, you know, I would have thought that it would be based on whether there is some voluntary transmission of that information, or if they're forced to do so by operation of law, then there's a good argument to say that it's not. But, you know, that's just my guess.
I can see a fascinating court case in
the future. Yeah.
Well, on the other hand, only if you downloaded some GPLP SD software and altered it, why would you... Okay, it might be not be very might be valuable, but would you really contest that in court? I wouldn't.
Yeah, but you still have to have provenance for the code. It's one thing to have a piece of source code and say, that's cool, yeah, I don't mind using it. And another thing to have a piece of source code you think you've built it around as a business. And there you really want to know that there are no legal questions pending for the future about how a piece of code is extracted. Because the legal bills for that, and things like, remember the old question, what is due diligence? And the usual answer being £150 an hour. Doesn't mean that it may be more cost effective to write the code again anyway. I don't know, I've always found that things like universities, if you ask them nicely, they will give me the code I wanted. When they've done
this. Just an example.
Yeah. Because I've had one or two cases like that. I've actually gone to look, you know, I gather you've done this. And they said, well, look, we don't want to release it. I actually had one memorable company that basically said, look, we will give you the code. We'll give you a letter to prove that we're giving you this value, it's GPL code for this particular extension, on the condition you absolutely and utterly promise never to reveal who gave it to you. Because we're not a computer company. And we don't want people emailing or phoning us up about it. We don't want to be involved. So, yeah. I've always found it worth asking people. Because there's a lot of code out there people haven't released. Because, like, well, nobody wants it. Or it'll be hassle. And sometimes if you come and meet somebody and say, look, well, we'll take all the hassle off you. All of a sudden, it's like, yeah, sure, go ahead. It's an interesting question. Do you know about the data protection related one?
No.
There's some interesting things in data protection law which read kind of into this area, and you correct me on the legal bits here. But the data protection law, for an automated decision, gives you the right to know how the decision was made.
And if it was made by a computer?
If it was made by some random piece of third-party proprietary software, certainly various people I've talked to in local government are a little worried that someday someone is going to push that to court, and they're going to be in a very awkward situation. Mm-hmm. Because they're going to have to say, well, this decision was made automatically, we don't know why. Particularly things like credit decisions or decisions about who gets a house. One of the ones that is potentially pending is to do with who gets picked for the council house first. And if that's a piece of it bought in software, as is commonly the case, which does all the rating and rollings, and someone says, why did he get the house first? Here's my £10, please tell me.
Yeah. Hi, Stuart Wilson here. A slightly different question, really, going back to the question that you asked about the adoption of open source by the commercial sector and obviously the government sector as well. We work in the commercial sector, work with banks and telcos, banks and so on. I'm very much up at the higher end of the stack rather than down at the Linux, you know, the lower infrastructure. And I sort of see the battle has pretty much commenced and is well on its way in terms of establishing market share down at the infrastructure tier. And I see very much its early days slightly above that going up into the apps tier. Would the panel like to comment on the success of I guess, that battle slightly up the stack, especially there's an interesting acquisition by Red Hat at JBoss. And the implications of that, I think that marks the start of potentially a whole new...
I think that's on that. Given the JBoss acquisition is, as I understood, still partly ongoing. I can't comment on it for two reasons. Yeah. One, US Securities Exchange Commission law. Two, I don't know anything about it.
Okay. Well, forgetting the JBoss...
Well, let somebody else comment on it.
Higher up the stack, is it?
I know nothing about it, but I'm happy to comment.
Yeah.
In fact, it's something I'm very interested in at the moment, because these kind of enterprise stack wars, which is the kind of term that's been bandied around, in many ways, at least from a sort of observer journalistic viewpoint, are where all the interesting things are starting to happen. Because as you say, I mean, in a sense, the kind of GNU Linux stuff is one. I mean, you know, everyone's starting to use it now. And even at layers above that, I mean, everyone's using Apache, and then you've got the big databases are running on GNU Linux, so you've got the data centers are starting to use it. So what's the next bit? Right, middleware. Okay, so you've got the GLU now. So you've got JBoss, and then you've obviously got Gluco was bought by IBM last year and is now the WebSphere application community edition. So that's starting to happen there. So I think this is really where the battle is starting, but I'm looking further ahead of that, further up the stack. It's extraordinary what's happening. You've got business intelligence. There are about 7 or 8serious open source packages out there from Pentaho and all these kind of people. They just sprang up from nowhere. You've got enterprise content management systems. Again, there's about 7 or 8 packages there. You've got, what are the other ones? You've got systems management. There's this new open management consortium, which is a group of 5 companies that are trying to make a kind of systems management stack. I mean, you've got these stacks spring up all over the place. I mean, it's really, really active. And for me, that's the demonstration that the battle has been won down the bottom, because everyone's assuming that you build on this base. And now the sort of manoeuvring and the battling side, you're right, it's very early days. A lot of these companies will fall by the wayside. The fact that 6 or 7 proves that. I mean, there's only going to be room for 1 or 2. But clearly, 1 or 2 winners will emerge, and then they'll start engaging with the proprietary lot. And then the final sort of jewel in the crown is obviously the enterprise resource management, the enterprise resource planning, the ERP stuff, and you start attacking SAP. So, I mean, I think that's the last stage. But before that, you've got these kind of mini stacks starting to work out. You've got the content management, you've got the systems management, you've got all the business intelligence. So for me, just as an observer, that's really where all the exciting stuff is starting to happen.
Do you think that'll be they're as successful as sort of the
Well, I think so, but then I'm biased, you know. Right. I mean, I think the dynamics are the same. You know, the dynamics are the same.
It's interesting because I asked the question to about an audience of about 200 at the Prince's Trust event, the Technology Leadership Group, which you may be aware of. I think it was Richard Holloway who was presented from Overland on there. And there just seems to be this general apathy and sort of disregard for anything open source by the likes of the Foresters, the...
Absolutely. But they reflect the status quo. They reflect the status quo. But also, I mean, as a journalist, it just really gets my goat that these people are quoted, but I mean, all they do is reflect back. I mean, it's an echo chamber. Absolutely. They never tell you the future. They just tell you the present and the past. Absolutely. And everybody always echoes it back. So as a journalist, it really annoys me that these people are quoted as if they're oracles, you know. Of course. Well, for the reasons we've discussed, because the companies want somebody to back them up. Say, well, they said it first, you know, don't blame me. And it's just this fear and this, you know, this lack of any kind of guts, which when you're sort of looking at these things in an abstract sense, luckily one isn't sort of limited by it. But I can quite understand that.
Now, I think with this, the top of the stack, there ought to be more, not less, opportunities, because much more of it is built around service and support. I mean, I don't know how you feel about it. My feeling is if the open source stuff got right up towards the very top of the stack, it would not be somebody battling SAP. My feeling is that SAP could go open themselves and maintain their business quite happily.
Sure. If they had the courage, but on the basis of some of their pronouncements, you can't really see that happening. I mean, I agree, yeah. Because the closer you get to the business, the more customization you need, and therefore the more services you need. But,
bingo.
Yeah, I mean, we can see that, but unfortunately they can't. They're running the company, but they can. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that you say this dichotomy between, you know, what we're saying here, where it seems obvious to us that this is where it's all going to be happening and there's huge opportunities, and as you say, the other side saying, well, we don't see anything, you know.
I think it's good to what this guy was saying earlier on in terms of this scepticism in the business about it, and it's not so much down at the infrastructure, it's more about what they see in terms of the implications that they see.
It depends on which business. From my perspective, what I do is I'm a practitioner. I transition businesses to open source systems. From my perspective, I see very few businesses which are sceptical about it. But that's because I'm working with the ones who are migrating to it.
I reiterate that as well. We do a similar thing, just more about the application space. But there's always this continual daily discussion with CIOs or IT directors who say, it's more from an ignorance point of view.
Absolutely, it's absolutely the biggest enemy, and in the ignorance front, it's ignorance of the kind of companies who are deploying open source systems on a massive scale, and at all sorts of layers of the stack. you're bang on the money. That is precisely where open source is going. And we're seeing it in specific companies who were designed to deliver a complete stack. You've got people like Spike Source, you've got people like Source Labs, yeah? And expect to see a lot more of it in future. People, the next frontier is integrating different open source projects, different open source systems to deliver business results.
I think I disagree slightly on that.
Please do.
Because one of the smartest comments I ever heard from someone doing my master's thesis was from a company who will remain nameless, whose director said, I want to build a system where I don't know and I don't care what is underlying my system. He didn't want to buy a complete solution stack because he wanted to be able to make sure people were competing on all the different bits. And anything which meant that the middleware locked in the bottomware was just as bad as the bottomware locking in the middleware.
But I think there's a difference between integration and actually bolting together.
Right.
But you're talking about clean APIs where they fit together.
Yes, but the point, you've got people trying to sell you the whole stack.
Yes.
They have this nasty habit of using different bolts to everybody else.
Well, that's the issue. You've got to make sure you can always still slip out the various layers and slip in something new. But you still need somebody to do that work for you.
So in summary, I guess the panel saying they see it being unanimously agreed to see just as being as aggressive in terms of the growth in that space as it has been down at the
And
the
even world. Gartner will say that in 2 or 3 years. I mean, you just got to
wait. Well, it's true.
You just keep saying it, Catherine.
You have to. You're absolutely right. Yeah.
So just following on that, I mean, it's interesting to hear about the first applications that people obviously worked at. But it's still... something I'm not very clear about in my mind is the client side, basically, which is, of course, the dominant, dominated by Microsoft, etc. What do you think is actually happening there now? Or what do you think ought to be happening? I mean, because I noticed that the, was it Mark Shuttleworth?
He's found
the aggressive mentality, but his expectations were that if Ubuntu was really successful, they might take something like 5% of the market. Why so low? Why are the whereas on the server side, behind the scenes, expectations are always much higher. You know, Apache is, 70%, something like that. And surely that's what we should be aiming at.
I know this gentleman here, well, I know all of these gentlemen are going to have some interesting perspectives on this, but I'd like to kick off with, I think there's disproportionate emphasis put on the desktop because that's the way that most people relate to computing. It's the thing that's directly in front of them. If you look at the free software market, it is way, way, way wider than desktop or even server side. There's massive amounts happening in the embedded space, and I'm going to... I know Anna's got loads on this one, actually. But the desktop is happening and will continue to happen and stuff like that, but for a lot of people, it's one of the least interesting areas.
It's the political aspect of it, which is the most interesting, because it is precisely that. It's that part that so many people see who don't understand.
You could say it's the last part, though, because it's the rest of it, and then you just do the kind of, icing on the top.
Bingo, absolutely.
So I would say
that you see that as a consequence.
If you look at it as well, there are massive inroads into the desktop, and we're going to see massive inroads more. Some of the interesting things that we're seeing now is the open document formats, and the document formats there. If you look at the phenomena of the takeoff of Firefox or as the browser on the desktop, there are areas where it's penetrating like you would believe.
Yeah, because that's like 20%, 25% of its market.
Depending on which country.
Well, it's 19.4% across Europe, I happen to see. Called the CT monitor, the French monitor. And UK is right down the bottom, with 12%. Scandalous.
It is scandalous, yeah.
We always have been. Same with things like OS2. It's interesting, have a look. The OS2 adoption numbers, compare them with the Linux and the Firefox adoption numbers, the same kind of numbers a year's in. It's very intriguing.
Mm.
It suggests it's a cultural thing.
Yeah, it must be. But to pick up, as you're saying, I mean, I do very much see the desktop as the last thing, and the pattern I see is starting down the bottom where, GNU Linux and Apache and all these have won in the infrastructure.
Oh, yeah.
But now moving up into the middleware where some interesting things happening, and then you've got these stacks, which is right at the beginning. And then after that, you'll start to get rollout of enterprise desktops. And the reason it'll happen there is because the powers that be will say, well, look, we've saved all this money down in the server room. Why aren't we doing this on the desktop? So that will prove to them that it works. And then they'll do that. And then when everyone's using open source desktops in the office, they'll start saying, well, why are we spending all this money at home? So the home will be the last place, in fact, that you actually see an open source desktop because of the huge reluctance to change, unless there's, you know, a really good reason. And that reason will come from the fact you're doing it at work. And you realise it's not actually that difficult. So I think we've actually got it round the wrong way. Everyone's been focusing on the desktop for the last 5 years. But as I said, it'll be the last thing that happens, and all of the really important stuff will have happened by then.
Yeah. If I can just turn off my brain as a lawyer for a second, I'll talk from, as a user. I mean, I think that the Microsoft theory of having a computer on every desk is just fundamentally wrong. I mean,
in 1970.
Yes, fine. But you know, the computing power needs to be where it needs to be in the appropriate place. And if you look at the stack, it's that you've got a desktop here and you've got the browser on top. And you know, Microsoft have been correct in saying the browser is going to be a very important place. But we need technologies like Ajax, for example, that start providing, you know, significantly more interactive experience when you're using the browser. Then suddenly the browser is capable of delivering applications that just weren't able to be delivered before, and that's the point at which the desktop becomes much less relevant.
So you think that the internet's changed the sort of business model? Because when Microsoft's business model, their vast billions, is based purely on the desktop.
Essentially.
That has changed. That is changing those trends. That the power that gives you.
Yes, I think the power that gives. I mean, if anyone's read the book about the initial architecting of NT, and you know, the fundamental decision that was made at the very early design stage is that it was going to be a single user operating system. I mean, that's absolutely crazy. I mean, why the hell would you design an enterprise single user operating system when, you know, Unix has been around for donkey's years and just wasn't, you know, sort of deliberately crippled. And that was really, you know, the first overtly political decision that Microsoft had made, and that's the point at which I say, you know, the lot set in. You know, I've used a lot of Microsoft products, and I think a lot of them are very good. But I think this insistence that, you know, all of the relevant computing power has to sit on the desk, and that the whole of the Microsoft philosophy is based on that, is the biggest danger to that is the fact that once you have the browser capable of communicating rapidly enough with, you know, whichever computer, wherever it happens to be, then suddenly the desktop suddenly becomes irrelevant. It doesn't matter what platform you're interrogating whatever server
it has
to be.
Another reason why at some point the CIO is going to say, well, you know, let's save the 50% because you're going to be using browsers anyway. What do you care about?
Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, I'm ordering you to do it, so forget it.
Yeah.
Everyone will.
I think things that things I've generally seen for desktop, and again, the master's thesis roughly backs up what I've seen. The areas that desktop Linux is currently doing well, and we talk about open source as operating systems on the desktop, are the ones we've seen are where there's a particular task to be done, because then you don't have the problem needing a large amount of software on one machine. Big businesses, because they tend to be in the cases where they've got enough computers that they say, oh, well, so the packing people need a web browser, a word processor, an email program, we'll give them Linux. The accountants, oh, they need Sage, well, that's hard, we'll stay on Windows. Not in small businesses generally, because a lot of small, even though some of the small businesses are very technical, a lot of them have got the computer. And therefore the computer has to run Sage and everything else they depend on. So if there's one single software package missing, they can't switch. The biggest success, I think, of all, though, has been environments which I like to describe as employee hostile. Call centres, hotel front desk, this kind of thing. Places where some of these people are even switching from things like Windows to Linux because they cannot lock Windows down enough. And they're fed up with this kind of 3-monthly virus sweep of their hotel front desk computer. Remove all the Flash games, the copy of Quake that mysteriously appeared there, and this kind of stuff. And also they're worried about it from a regulatory point of view, because if all this crap is getting onto their hotel computer, then potentially all of this private personal data is getting off it. So we've seen very, very big wins there. As to desktop and other things, something I think perhaps we got the wrong model wrong on when people were looking at it was this idea that that's with the server, you'd start the desktop by attacking the bottom. But desktop's very different, in the sense that a lot of what you see from the desktop are the top-level applications. And so it appears where the shifts are happening, this is something I never expected until I saw it, is at the top level. So the top-level applications are changing. People go, oh, it's Firefox, GIMP, OpenOffice.
Yeah.
And at some point in the future, they're going to go, oh, those are all available for Linux. well, Windows Vista is so much Linux, you're saying, yeah, I think we'll try Linux then. Well, this is good. And so the stack is actually coming the other direction, which is a bit strange. The one I really don't know the answer to, though, is this whole question about whether the browser is what will matter. Because we have a younger generation today whose fundamental interaction with, to an extent now, even becoming even more so the internet, but their fundamental mode of interaction with everything around them in the information age is one of these. And so there's going to, for a lot of people, you're going to question whether they'll ever have a desktop. You see that in Japan. There's a lot of people in Japan, they live by their phone, not by their computer. The computer is something you can go to when you want to type in a document, look at something in detail. The real world lives on one of these, and that's the web. I don't know how much that will matter.
Well, again, that fits in with my theory that you'll see open source desktops, as you say, top down, appear in the companies first, and then in the home, maybe it'll never turn up because people have turned to the telephones by then, or if they do, they'll be the last to convert for all the kind of social reasons.
I should ask in response to that, what you're saying about this migration of the desktop. You talked about companies, small and large, but what about universities and places that have been running maybe servers based on open software for a long time? They've got the technical expertise to run it. So why aren't universities running open source desktops?
There's multiple reasons. There are political hotspots is one of them as well. There's differential pricing for software in universities, and the whole education sector is very targeted by proprietary vendors.
Yeah, that's one way I would say. There's so much. Effectively, in the proprietary world, there is so much subsidy of sales to educational establishments in order to create familiarity with those products so that people demand those products, that the universities aren't really paying very much for a lot of their software like that. We are doing, I mean, in the case of Red Hat, for example, we are doing university deals where we're doing the kind of low-price deals under certain conditions for stuff. And there are a lot of universities that have Linux desktops in the computer science department, but they have Windows desktops everywhere else. And I've talked to a couple of universities about it. And it's, the other answer they give is not just the business one. And there is the business one. Hey, we pay almost nothing for it. We've got a site license. Why switch? There is also one that they feel majority of their students today going out in the world will need to understand Windows first of all. Most of the people they're teaching, they're not teaching as computing people. They're people who need survival skills in computing. And therefore, they should give them the best survival skills they can that they're likely to need as they go on into a job.
In business, that's the thing.
In business.
That's why
from a university point of view, business is asking them for Windows skills.
As soon as business changes,
then the universities will switch.
Exactly. So they'll be one of the later ones, paradoxically, for all the recent
damages. So they're already doing computer science because there is a huge demand for students who understand open source. But
and I fear the same as in schools as well, because of that huge inertia, the sense the children will need this in their jobs. We can't possibly not do Excel. We can't possibly not do Word. They won't get employed. And so you've got to change the employers first, and then the schools will say, oh yeah, we've got to do that.
In the meantime, we've taught several years people the wrong thing.
Exactly. But
it's going to happen. Yeah.
Presumably it's also packages as well that are already built on the default, which is Microsoft. It also affects the adoption as well, and that the equivalent application isn't available on Unix or open source.
Sometimes. Most of the university students don't need much software. There are certain things, obviously SAS, SPSS, stuff like that, which can be trickier. I don't know in depth on that. But there is also a lot of stuff which is only available on things like Unix platforms that these people use as well. But they always tend to use it on the back end.
I think also that's why the ODF is very important, because it decouples
yes.
the document from the platform, and it makes people realise that they're not really interested in Microsoft Word, it's just Microsoft Word's file format. And that if you just change it slightly and don't use too many macros, you can actually use ODF, and then, oh, you don't actually need Microsoft Word, and oh, you don't need Windows. I mean, it's just breaking that kind of dependence that people have, and they don't realise what they're dependent on. And ODF, I think, is going to be a tremendous kind of Trojan horse for open source in that respect.
Just building on the point of education,
Do you think that, to some extent, research, well, in the area of IT, for example, is held back a bit by the proprietary world in that, as you've said, there's a sort of belief that, as it were, that the money for these research projects is coming from the proprietary world, and therefore it creates a kind of situation where it keeps out its own software, as it were. Yeah. Does that make sense?
Well, because they've no incentives.
Well, in other words, where research is funded, clearly funded by an organisation, a commercial organisation, that's quite often thought in the university world as that's fantastic, because you've got this funding in. But obviously, if the funding is coming from proprietary firms, that also must create a barrier to the adoption of open source. I mean, does that question make any sense?
Yes, it does. Sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. An awful lot of good open source has come out of Cambridge on the back of some Microsoft funding. So sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't.
But you wouldn't wish to elaborate on that too much.
Go and have a look at Zen.
Zen, right. Okay. I'm aware of it.
Yeah. I think that's what I've seen in universities. There's a lot of stuff where funding goes in to develop things like software, which is coming from big companies, and it's not necessarily companies wanting proprietary, particularly now. Absolutely. There are some very, very big backers of open source who are very heavy investors in the research world. There is also software coming out of research in non-computing areas where the software is in effect a byproduct. So, for example, a lot of research in the medical sector produces software that does analyses. And quite often software does these analyses is not of any inherent value to the people who create it. It's valuable in the sense of here, prove my research correct. So there's that aspect. There's another thing goes on, which is, I think at the moment, not affecting the proprietary funding stuff so much, but is beginning to have an impact, which is the way you used to do your research. For example, say you want to do some clever operating system scheduler. You create a mini mock operating system. You put your scheduler in it, you do your research, you prove your scheduler is better than others in suitably defined circumstances, you publish two or three papers and you get your PhD. It's the theory anyway. What seems to be happening a lot more now is you take an existing operating system, you're allowed to tinker with, which rather limits the choice. You do your research in it, the license says you must publish this publicly if you do so. And so you end up choosing to publish it, not necessarily because you're thinking, well, it's valuable, all this, but simply it is the easiest way to get the project done. So I could spend 3 months on the beach, or surfing, or I could spend 3 months writing a mini mock operating system to throw away to prove my research is correct. At the end of the day, I still get a PhD. Are you going to write the operating system or are you going surfing? So there's that kind of incentive. And that's only just starting to become a commercial incentive. In that companies are starting to realise, well, this software, the software output of this research is not intrinsically of value. So if we use open source bits to do it quicker and faster, who cares? But I think that's only beginning.
Just writing on the back of that question, with research, when it's published, the sort of wow factor, is basically having the paper appeared and refereed and that. And the sort of advent of blogs, etc. To some extent, if you put something on a blog that really hasn't been voiced before, you can with certain conferences, you can actually write yourself out of being able to do a paper because they won't accept it because it's already appeared. Do you see the point? And I think I saw a program with Colin Pilger, with the sort of guiding light of the ill-fated beagle, and he sort of more or less raised this point about academic research in that most people aren't really invited in because it's obviously its research paper is refereed by maybe do you think to some extent that the blog methodology or format or whatever suffers to some extent as a result of that?
Well, as I mentioned before, there is this open access movement, which again is very closely akin to the open source. And this is trying to break open the whole kind of cartel of academic publishing, whereby, you probably know the Public Library of Science, which is the most high-profile example. And in fact, certainly one of the people behind that, Patrick Brown, told me that open source was one of the direct inspirations for that. And that's really trying to put scientific and academic discourse in the public arena, in make it into another commons, as we said before. And I think that goes some way to addressing those issues, because they are confronted by precisely those problems, because there are two kinds of open access, the so-called green open access and golden open access. And the green open access is where you just put a preprint on your local server so that anyone can look at it. And the golden open access is where you publish it in an official open access journal. But if you're putting it out as a preprint, then you've got the same problem that, in a sense, has already been published. So at what point does a blog entry become a preprint? So I think open access is implicitly examining all those assumptions about what it means to publish, and rightly so, because there's been a very sort of ossified approach. We get these ridiculous situations. I mean, you know, you're trying to get information out into the public, so what's the problem? I mean, that's what research is about. So clearly we've got to change how we do that.
Yes.
I mean, it's something that academics I've been trying to sort of grapple with from a sort of moral perspective. Talking to a couple of academics that were at university a couple of weeks ago, and you know, there's a lot of concern about plagiarism at the moment, and it's very difficult to climate that we have at the moment of, you know, easy access to a wide range of information and the availability through the mechanism of the blog to enable sort of instant responses on, you know, whatever comments that you choose to post up there. You know, what's the point at which what you finally produce as your thesis is essentially all your own work, or who's contributed to it? And you know, it's interesting. You know, we're talking about preparing people to go into sort of commercial life and have jobs, etc. The fact of the matter is that, you know, obviously, from a practical point of view, to get the best possible product, if you're being asked to do something in the commercial world, to get the best possible product, you want to get the maximum number of sensible inquiries, maximum amount of information out there. So that's not regarded as plagiarism; that's regarded as a sensible way to go about doing business. But the academics are sort of wrestling with the thought, you know, at what point does garnering all of this information from a much wider cadre of people than you would previously amount to plagiarism? Or at what point is it just sort of sensible means of doing the research that you're supposed to be doing anyway?
It's really changing the nature of what academic research means.
Yes, absolutely.
Things have changed,
absolutely.
And really that needs to change too.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the end product is going to be better. There's no question of that. The question is whether it's actually as worthy of the badge of a PhD as a result of going through that process than it would have been just talking to a much smaller group of people that are in your personal experience.
Yes. I should own up here about it. I mean, I've got to a point where I'd like to write some stuff, but it's a bit too close to what I might like to put in a paper. So it's a real dilemma, you know. As I have to be doing a PhD myself, it's a real issue, because if you chuck it in there at the wrong conference, that you.
But in fact, this issue has already been addressed in this world of open genomics by informatics 10 years ago, because people were publishing. Or rather, people were sequencing the genomes of various organisms, and they had this dilemma: should they put this data in the public domain, which is what the community spirit said you should do? But if you did that, then somebody might stick it in a computer and do all the analysis and do your paper before you had a chance to do it. Or you keep it yourself, do all the analysis, and then put the data in the domain, but in which case you've really gone against the spirit of the community, which says all data should be in the open. So they've had a couple, and in the end, they came to the sort of consensus view is that you put the data out in the open, but there's a kind of gentleman's agreement that you don't zoom in and then pull out the kind of easy, low-hanging fruit. You know, you're allowed to start number crunching, but you don't rush to print, because it's pretty clear that you've just done that to get the first result. So maybe that's a kind of solution that you've got to kind of generate a kind of consensus view within the community of what's fair and what isn't fair.
Yeah.
You're allowed to use other people's work, but not to the extent of actually preempting their own research. And again, if you kindly put some information out there, people then don't take advantage of it. They can use it, but they mustn't actually exploit it to your detriment.
I mean, what we're sort of talking about here really is in your area really is a few steps on. We're ultimately we're looking at a different society, aren't we? Really,
and yeah, we're sharing these issues.
Absolutely. A lot of the political issues around free software are exactly that, because there are rules which are applicable to methods of development of things which were applicable 100, 200 years ago, or maybe they weren't, and there are new rules that are needed now which don't really map.
Which picks up what we're doing. Saying about copyright and
patents. Absolutely.
It really just changes everything.
Absolutely.
It goes well beyond just open source and academia, though. Mm. I mean, it's... It really, I think, started, I suppose, in the 70s. Because we used to have this thing where there was copyright was something which existed in the industrial world, in the sense that people didn't own things that caused copies to occur. So copyright law could be complicated, and it didn't really matter because everyone had their corporate lawyer look at it before they churned off 1,000 copies or something. And then we had this curious dichotomy, which we still have today, where a small kid goes to school and the teacher says, share that book. They go to the school libraries, there's a big sign saying, do not make copies of that book.
And also, when they log onto the internet, they are downloading a copy of other people's material every sign on the web page.
And they're doing vast amounts of stuff, which is building things from other people's information. If you think about a blog with comments, it is kind of like the ultimate legal definition of a derivative work. It's like a mass derivative work. And we haven't really just... There's all the privacy issues go with that. There's all the questions of the way teenagers today treat information. Yeah. The kind of things they will put on the internet, the way they will behave with them. So they will put stuff on the internet and then be upset, for example, if their parents look at some of it. There's a different set of rules. And there are currently sociologists running around today desperately trying to figure out what these rules are. And the same goes, so to speak, right up the stack. Mm.
I mean, even talking to IP lawyers about this sort of stuff, you know, it's sort of very, very interesting talking to my colleagues, and, you know, they are all proponents of the, you know, the phrase intellectual property, and they believe in terms of, very much in terms of the rights that you know, because they're acting for their clients tend to be big organisations on the whole, so thinking very much in terms of property and rights. And when I point out to them that effectively most lawyers have been operating in terms of sort of commons as far as the precedent documents that we use, you know, lawyers are very good at nicking other bits of documents from you know, if I'm in a transaction, but you know, document comes over,
it's like Disney has been rather good at taking the commons.
And that sort of works because there is a sort of gentleman's agreement between lawyers that we don't sue each other for nicking our copyright. And secondly, because the micro control hasn't really existed in the past anyway, it's been very much macro control, and that's why I'm very concerned about digital rights management, which I'm more than happy to be called digital restrictions management, because that actually means that, you know, it's no longer possible for that gentleman's agreement between lawyers to take effect anymore, and we can no longer say, oh, that's a useful phrase from that particular contract, I might adopt that.
There's no fair dealing, so, is it?
No, not in a commercial context. So, I mean, that's...
I'm just waiting for people to patent legal arguments. So you can't bring that legal argument, that's mine.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Any more questions from the floor? We've been going for about an hour and a half. I don't know.
There's something I wanted to ask, because it hasn't been mentioned at all. It's sort of slightly off, but it's related. What about John? What's the relevance? Does John have a relevance in the notion of John community process to the forward movement of software? So there are a lot of people saying that Sun should put it, Java should be put into the public domain. Other people saying it's irrelevant, it's had its day. I mean, it's had a significant role in the business community. What does it represent, anything of interest?
Certainly a test case for Sun, I think. Whether Jonathan Schwartz is going to do something different to hear from Neely. I think that's one interesting thing. Since I'm not a programmer, I don't really feel confident to discuss the technical merits, but it'll be a test case, what he does with it, whether he makes it like GPL. He actually mentioned in his blog the other day that GPL is on the table. I think if he did take Java open source under the GPL, that would be a very strong signal, if nothing else. Whether it's a wise thing to do, I don't know, but it would be a very strong signal about Sun's intention.
Yeah, I think it's really up to Sun. I mean, Java has certainly a success in things like mobile phones, televisions and stuff. And that's been a success built on very, very strong standards and enforcement of standards, which is a problem if you then want to say, oh, yeah, you do anything you like with it. So there's a dichotomy there. If Sun could figure out the right way to split the language, the name, as in the trademark, and the code, I think they would be in much better circumstances. Clearly, the Java name needs to mean something. The whole thing was built around this idea of write once, run anywhere, or at least write once, debug everywhere. They tried. The code, if they want everyone to be using Java, there needs to be an open source Java system. People need to be able to modify it and change it, but equally there needs to be no confusion. If your modified Java system does not pass the Java test, then it ain't a Java system. And you don't call it Java, you don't claim it's Java, you don't call it, put it in user bin Java, etc. It ought to be possible to figure out how to put those together. If they can do that, then I think Java's got a bright future. If they can't do that, then I suspect the subset of .NET, which appears to be clear of patents, based on the ECMA process and stuff, is going to mean that in 10 years' time, Java will be looked at one of those things where somebody got it right and blew the business decisions, and somebody else came along and cleaned up. They won't be the first. This happened with Motif. A long, long time ago, people were saying, open source Motif. And the open group said, oh no, we're the open group, we don't open anything. Some years later, they changed their mind, and they came back to the community and said, okay, we're going to open source Motif. Everyone said, okay, and? They're going to go, you got to ship it? Well, we'll put in the extra disk, we've got a bit of room. No one cared. Its time had gone. Because it had stayed proprietary, and been underinvested in, everyone else had gone past it. And that's what is going to happen to Java if Sun don't figure out how to make the process work with for everybody. Or to an extent, to be fair, if IBM figure it out. Because I'm a bit lost when I'm trying to work out who at Sun or IBM actually owns more bits of Java these days.
Is it really relevant what they think? Because at the end of the day, there are so many work in the Java space, and there's plenty of businesses that are moving towards that whole Java space, and they're still stuck in very old 4GL space, just to move to our own concept. Is a revelation to half of them. For me, it's a done deal. It's already there. It's just a question of whether, how much of it will exist in 10 years' time. And irrespective of what IBM and Sun think, there are so many other driving forces out there that are pushing that whole thing forward. And
there are lots.
The Spring framework is a good example of something that came along to fix a whole bunch of deficiencies in the Java.
And there are things, I'm going to get wrong, there are things happening in the Java world. But there are things happening in the .NET world.
Yeah.
And if we end up in this ridiculous situation, I'm sure what Microsoft really wants to happen, where the core of the .NET technologies is more freely available than Java, and it can deliver the same things or better. Once that community grows bigger, you will get very fast tipping effects, I suspect. And a large number of developers are going to go, that's a really cool library. I'll do my next one with .NET. I went to India in Bangalore, and the talk in Bangalore, all the people who were there, was .NET, not Java. They're all doing .NET programming for big businesses in Europe and the US. So I think Sun are pretty close to the point where they've got to move or they're going to lose it. It's only an opinion. No doubt Sun management feel differently to see what they decide to do.
Perhaps I could just ask one question myself for everyone as a slightly sort of cheeky follow-up to that. When people think that Ubuntu will become the official Sun operating system?
I think it just has, isn't it?
Well, I mean, when they get rid of the yellow one.
Well, wasn't it Red Hat at one point, SUSE at another, and now Ubuntu? I don't know. Presumably it's whichever one suits their flavour of the week or they get the best deal of on the day.
Maybe, but it's interesting how it's starting to muscle in.
I'm sure they will keep at least two. It's like IBM. IBM is always, there are always going to be two IBM distributions at least that IBM will always support. Because IBM created Microsoft and they're not going to make that same mistake again.
Okay, well, it's 8:30. I think we, I think that's pretty well the question. So it's a fantastic sort of event here. We still have some food. I think we still have some food. I haven't been there for some while. So I've heard a bit of noise. I'm not sure if the catering staff have wanted to go home or what, but I suspect there's some stuff there. I hope there's some stuff there anyway. So, what's left of us? I think we'll give a resounding clap.
I'll give you my card.
Yes.
I'm getting increasingly interested in this.
It's a fascinating question. I mean, I find the whole terminology thing. I mean, if I were to suggest that, you know,
well, that's
right.
The word intellectual monopoly, it's a story.
Why can't we start using it?
Well, no, I think.